Hello, friends and listeners of the Unschool Files podcast. I'm your host, Megan, and you are listening to episode 2 of season 2. This season, we are really focusing on a series of episodes around self-directed education and community care. We started this season off with a reading of Alexander Coast's article, Education is a Political Act, self-directed in parentheses. And in this episode, I'm sharing the conversation that him and I had afterwards. We discuss his path to self-directed education. We talk about teenagers, youth rights, how his article was initially received by folks in the self-directed community. And we make some key clarifications while we go into some nuances around freedom with the three different focuses in his article, which are a focus on autonomy, a focus on community, and autonomy through mutual aid. So this one's kind of a long one, but I promise it's really good and you're going to want to listen to it all. So join me in welcoming Alex back to the podcast.
Okay, so my name's Alexander Coast. I am a youth rights advocate and a father, among many other things I do in my life, but specifically with regards to what we're talking about. And as I mentioned in the article, I started out just as a dad who didn't like the way that he went, you know, how I grew up. And I didn't like my schooling and I wanted something different for my kids. And I started out I'm a certified teacher in New York State and had been teaching for years and just thought of myself as an educator. And more and more as I started shifting from conventional education into self-directed education, I started realizing that I wasn't really an educator at all. What I was doing was supporting young people's right to choose for themselves. A quick side tangent for a second. I like to view this as, imagine a barricade of people arm in arm, holding off the masses, the crowds. And these people are pushing back the masses and the crowds. And in front of them, what they're defending are a bunch of children sitting there playing. And if you can think of that visually, a bunch of children just sitting there playing, and there's a bunch of adults sort of pushing back or older people pushing back against the crowds. That's kind of what I see my role as a youth rights advocate and the role of facilitators or unschooling parents in general is you're not really doing much other than holding the rest of the world off from letting kids play and play and play and have the right to make the decisions that they want to make. And the deeper that I got into this, the more I realized that that's what I was doing. I was sort of guarding that right, which is ultimately something that shouldn't really be necessary. There should just be kids playing and my role shouldn't be necessary, but my role is necessary because of society. So with that said, I have three children who are all self-directed and a fourth one on the way.
Yay! Baby Coast is coming.
And I think that's the first time I'm officially announcing that. But
congratulations to the both of you.
Thank you so much. My first three kids are all technically unschoolers. My older two kids who are they're 16 and 14, but they're just about to turn 17 and 15 years old. They went through they started out when they were infants at the free school that I started. And then went through every different model and methodology that I went through, which was running summer camps, running a junk playground, running a flying squad, which is a self-directed group in a public space. But they also went to an agile learning center. They went to multiple different unschooling centers, all in New York City. And so they've seen a lot of different models. And then ultimately, once they hit kind of high school age, decided to become, to just unschool themselves, which is what they're doing now. And my my third child is an unschooler. She's six and has always been an unschooler. And I myself, you know, I founded a bunch of different models and different centers or schools and summer camps and things and a junk playground. So that basically gives a quick summary of who I am.
I am so inspired. I'm still hanging on at the visual of a barricade of adults and protecting children playing. I have been there this whole time you were talking. So I heard what you were saying and it all is there. And it's sitting and it's like sinking in. But I am just so inspired by that visual. And I'm really inspired by your dedication to, like, you have put so much time and energy into living that out, from the junk playgrounds to flying squads. If you want to talk about those, you can. But I just love the idea of young people occupying the city, occupying space that, like, we have somehow all as a society decided that, like, we're not supposed to see children during school hours, and this directly pushes back against that. And I love that and would love to see a flying squad in like every city.
there's quite a few of them now. It's been growing in the, I think, what is this, our fifth year, I believe, of flying squads. And there's now, I've stopped counting, but there are many of them in many different shapes and forms. And yeah, that's exactly it. The idea is, we talk about school and then the real world. And if you want to be a youth rights advocate, and if you want to be a young person who's an activist, you need to actually be out in the real world. It was quite shocking to me with flying squads, how challenging that was on an everyday basis. Like just walking down the street or walking into a shop, especially walking into shops, the amount of adults who would sort of in a hostile manner would go up to the young people I was with and be like, "Hey, you're supposed to be in school. What are you doing here? What's the matter?" Sort of I can remember one of the Brooklyn Flying Squad that I ran for years. One of the kids' favorite stories was the time that we were on a subway for a really long time, and they were all sort of like fidgeting, waiting, and we finally got off. And they ran out the door of the subway station down the sidewalk, like jumping and enjoy, not doing, but just making a little bit of noise and jumping up and down on a sidewalk. And this elderly person came up to me and was like, "I was in the Board of Education for 40 years. What's the matter with you?" And was yelling at me that I didn't have my kids in a line, ducks in a row. And started yelling at me and telling me that I should be ashamed of myself. But just how challenging a bunch of kids had enjoying themselves during school hours in a public space, like that's a nightmare definition by many people. That's children out in chaos it's just remarkable to me that
and surely up to no good. Surely.
Clearly, well, we were up to no good, so that's
You know what I think is really ironic about that entire worldview is those are oftentimes the same people who will say things like, flipping burgers at the Golden Arches or wherever is a job that's meant for teenagers. It's meant for young people, for their first jobs, for their blah, 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 blah. But those people are not welcome outside of school hours. So how is it that everyone is getting burgers served to them all day long if those jobs are really only for teenagers, but we don't really want teenagers out and about outside of school hours? Like, it's just such an ironic worldview to have, because it's kind of this worldview that says that kids really just can never do anything right. And we really just don't want to see them or hear from them because they're just a bother. That's really what it's saying.
I feel that really goes much at the root. Yeah, that really strikes at the heart of what conventional education is, just to pause for a second, I'm adamant and I'm always trying to point out the way that I say conventional education, not traditional education, because tradition means something longstanding. And if you look at the tens of thousands of years that humans have existed, the education, the way that young people were on a daily basis more than 150 years ago was you know, for the most of the history of being human, we were hunters and gatherers, and young people were self-directed and sort of taught each other and worked together. And what conventional education is something that's popular now, which is in the last 150 years or so, where we've made school compulsory and children have to sit down at desks and have to learn from authoritarian figure over them. That's something actually that's experimental and brand new in the history of humans. You know, not even 0.1% of human history has been what we're all used to as public schooling and its public-private schooling counterparts. But the conventional education really started or really gained popularity in the Industrial Revolution, where we needed, you know, cheap laborers. We needed a mass society of people working in factories and who, you know, had knew enough reading that they could read directions to machinery and reports, could knew enough writing so that they could write the reports, and enough arithmetic so that they could operate the machinery and that sort of a thing, which is literally where reading, writing, and arithmetic comes from, is the ability to give people just enough of an education that we could have them be our laborers in factories, but not be, and literally you can find the quotes in the original in their original doctrines that started public education, was that we don't want poets, we don't want writers, we don't want creative types who are thinking for themselves. We want docile humans who, you know, bend to our will, I believe is the wording that they use. So like literally you can look it up. It's in the John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. I forget the name of the document, but it's a publicly accessible document of right around the turn of the 20th century, how they planned to make these massive schools, to have them all work in their factories and make them rich. But, you know, we're talking about working at the Golden Arches or whatever, like, is just sort of a bit of an extension of that, is like, that's okay. We'll accept you if you're willing to behave and, you know, work for minimum wage,
right,
in our mass chains, to keep everybody docile and happy. That's if you don't want to be in school, it's fine to do that. But otherwise, please, you know, don't be seen or heard.
Mm-hmm. And there's a cap on it. There's a limit, you know, there's a limit to how long you're allowed to do that before you're a failure. You're not amounting to anything. This is not a job that's suitable for someone your age, like that you're never going to, like, all of that messaging is out there for young people. So like, as a young person, if you're lucky to have parents or caregivers or adults around you who help advocate for you or give you access to your freedom, then that's great. But many children, I would say most children, don't have access to a lot of that and are just kind of shushed and moved along through the process of childhood as like in training to be an adult. And that's kind of how childhood is looked at. And it's just so sad.
I think it's really important to bring this back to the article for a second, and the idea of political ideology and why this, what you just said, is so important that I hope I hit upon in the article a little bit, is, let's take, for example, the amount of people I have spoken to who send their kids to some sort of conventional education who say something along the lines of, my kid is happy there, or they're fine there, they're doing just fine in that school. That very well may be true. And it's still extremely concerning to me. And the reason why is that those children might be, even I kind of enjoyed conventional school from the academic standpoint, and having teachers giving me information, imparting their wisdom onto me as a kid. And didn't struggle with that. I struggled with the social end of it. But school isn't necessarily a place where everybody suffers. But that doesn't necessarily make it a good thing. And the reason why is you're still just learning obedience to authority. You're fitting into a political ideology that says it's top down. You listen to me, I know better than you. And when you do that for your entire childhood, and that's drummed into you over and over and over again, it's very hard to then go about and question that and to figure out a new model and a new way of living, which, you know, we all call de-schooling, the struggle to break out of that and to unlearn all of those unhealthy habits that we all learned as children in our own conventional upbringings. Now that we're saying, hey, that's not good for me, it's hard to find another way around that. And so just because your kid is doing well in public school or whatever doesn't mean that that's a good thing for them. If you want somebody who's actually happy and questioning the direction that they're going in life and making sure that they're taking care of themselves and that they're not just that laborer working to make the rich richer.
Yeah, I think many young people are going to be just fine going through school and coming out of school. But those young people, like, just fine doesn't necessarily mean, like, there could be a lot of opportunities that were just missed there in who they could have been or what they could have been, which is what I hear the most when I talk to older people who have either recently grown and launched unschoolers or maybe people who grew up as unschoolers, is that idea of, like, I don't know how I would have accessed this in me if I was locked away in school. Not to say that we should harbor guilt if we have to send our children to school either, because it's such a multiplicity of things that are true at the same time. Because some people do have to send their children to conventional schooling and they don't have a way around that. And that just is.
I think even within that, I think it's really important and healthy I don't think it needs to be an all or nothing. And I don't think that the enemy or the thing that we need to focus on completely is not sending our kids to public schools or military schools or charter schools or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. First off, you know, let's all acknowledge that public schools do, you know, in New York City provide, I think, what's it like 1.2, 1.3 million children with free lunches and heat in the winter. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that, and there are lots of caring, well-intentioned adults in those systems that are doing their best to take care of young people, and that they serve a certain purpose. And that, yeah, there are lots and lots of people because public education has a monopoly on funding for education. Any alternative to it is far out of reach for many, many people. Yes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to say, oh, well, then I throw in my gloves and give up. You can still, as a parent or a care provider of a young person a foster parent, it could even just be you're working with a young person in an after-school program or some volunteer program on Saturday mornings, or whatever, you can still open up the ability to give those young people a voice and to listen to them and respect them and help them realize that they have a voice. Simple things like let your kids decide how you're going to walk home when you have an extra hour. Or, you know, let them come to the grocery store and pick out some of the foods and come up with some of the recipes for what you all are going to have for dinner, or whatever time you can make to help young people have a voice in their own decision making. They can still be in public school and have that, and you can still be their supporter. Even my own parents who knew, you know, well, I guess my dad knew about self-directed education, but that my parents certainly weren't trying to practice it and didn't have any definition of, like, hey, I'm a youth rights advocate or something like that. But my parents, I can remember like my English teacher in high school accusing me of plagiarism, and my father going in and making the teacher apologize to me because he knew that I didn't plagiarize. And very begrudgingly, the teacher did. But that was a big moment for me in my own development of, you know, I was probably 15 years old, and there's an adult apologizing to me because my father pointed out, if you can be on the side of the young people you're with in any environment, you can help model for them and give them messages that will that have the potential to be long lasting and help them sort of question things and have a healthy attitude and strive towards their own autonomy. So I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I think there's so many opportunities for advocacy and offering up a space for, or like being a channel even, because sometimes all it takes in a group setting, like when you were talking, I was imagining settings where we've been like maybe with other families where other parents maybe aren't quite as open to their children being as honest maybe as mine are, but they sort of catch wind of their child being a little more vulnerable or honest than they're used to hearing, or maybe they hear a swear word, something like that, and kind of being the kind of adult that steps in and is like a channel for that being okay. You know what I mean? Like kind of giving the signal to the other parent, like, yeah, I remember using words that were a little more peppery than were heard by the adults then around me, you know, like reminding them that, like, because I know that we know intellectually that we were all teenagers at one point in time, but when it's your own child and you're in your own head, you know, about what future they may have or what kind of things you want to instill in them or what have you. Sometimes it's just good to be reminded by a peer, another adult peer that's like, hey, this is okay. We can give them this space, which happens a lot for us because we do not happen to be able to run with just unschoolers anymore. We did when our kids were very young, and now our community is so diverse around the world and everywhere we go that it's not possible to live in that beautiful bubble anymore. But it stretches those muscles of like extending our way of being into exactly what you're describing, into places and spaces where that way of thinking maybe doesn't exist. And framed in the way I live my life, it wouldn't exist for them either. But you can kind of like help blur the lines a little bit, you know, to give children a voice.
Yeah. I think another, just in you talking, made me think about the one other real important message that I always try and communicate to care providers, especially parents, people who feel the people who feel the responsibility for rearing a young person, that, you know, it's my responsibility. It's been placed upon me, that definition that we give to when how parent became a verb and became parenting, the reminder that is that to be gentle on yourselves, but also to check in with others as much as you possibly can. I try and say often, as a person I've spent, God, I don't know, 25 years now, being a huge advocate and a researcher and of self-directed education, and just a person who's invested his whole life into it. And yet here I am with my own kids doubting myself and all the time scared, like, oh my God, am I messing my kids up? And that's natural. And that the more unconventional, no matter what the whole point of being unconventional is, what you're doing, not a lot of people are doing, right? That's the definition of it.
Yes.
and so you're looking around saying, oh my God, everybody else is doing it this way and I'm doing it this way. And you know, you don't get a second shot at this. Like, you're either a good parent and your kids go off and are great kids and grow into responsible adults and have a good job and blah, 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 blah. Or they're a failure and they're, you know, homeless on the street and or talking to a therapist about what a terrible parent you were. And that can be really scary. One brief personal note that just happened to me the other day. My oldest son, as I mentioned, is about to turn 17, and he's decided he's an unschooler already. So when he says he wants to drop out of school, I'm not even sure what that means. but he doesn't really want to finish. He don't want to go on with school. He just wants to go and get a job. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And when we sat down and had a long conversation about it, he wants to be a carpenter. He wants to work in construction. And I have to admit, and I, like, you know, as a person who has a graduate degree and has read all the classic novels and is really sort of quite snooty in some ways, like, there was definitely an ingrained, I'm sorry, what?
Are you feeling a little sting there?
I was definitely feeling like a bit of that ingrained, like, oh, like, he doesn't want to go on and be an academic or something. Like, that hit me. And here I am all these years in. And interestingly enough, later the same day, my wife was talking to me, basically, our front door is broken. We had a locksmith come and fix it, charge us. We paid for it. And then the door broke again. And the locksmith came back and was like, all right, that's going to cost you another $100 or whatever. And I was like, wait a minute, you can't charge us twice. You're the one who didn't fix it the first time. And we have to pay him twice because we can't, you know, like, or we can go get another locksmith who's going to, but he's like, well, tough luck. And she was saying to me, like, well, there's not a lot of locksmiths out in the world. Not too many people work with their hands anymore. And I stopped for a second and was thinking, oh my, even if you're looking at it from a conventional standpoint, going into construction or being a carpenter or a locksmith or a plumber or an electrician is actually, even from a conventional standpoint, is you can be rich and extremely successful doing that. And how pigeonholed we are into thinking that, like, if you don't go on to college and you don't go and, you know, become a professor or whatever, you're a failure in life, and how often our minds go to that, and how, you know, and there I was nervous about my own son's direction in life, and then feeling so embarrassed for myself afterwards of my, clearly I still have my own de-schooling to do.
I think it's never ending. I really do.
Yeah, I do too.
I really do. I'm sorry, I cut you off in the middle and asked if it stung, because I'm laughing to myself because this literally happened today, like 2 hours before chatting with you. My 17-year-old, who is, you know, 6 months shy of 18-year-old, is straddling that world of, like, you know, youth and adulthood by legal standards, but not, and, like, it's just a weird time. It's a super weird time. It's a time of transition. There's not a real solid plan in place, but he has his ideas of how he wants to do things. And for his privacy, I won't go too much into detail, but I'll just say that the conversation today, I what I'm hearing now, or at least what I've heard from him today, is I'm good. I don't need a lot of your input anymore. You're the person I talk to at night before I go to bed when I get home. And thanks a lot. I appreciate you. I love you. And I will ask you if I need anything. That's kind of what I got. And part of me was humbled because I was kind of like, ooh, all right, sorry. Like, I was over, it's like over speaking and how we were going to, like, you know, micromanage this plan. Cause that's me, that I bullet journal and I write everything down and I, like, I'm very plan oriented. And he does not want that or need that or thrive that way. And, he just reminded me, like, I'm not like you, I'm not you, you're not me. And I'm pretty confident that, like, there's going to be a series of challenges over the next handful of years, and I'm ready to do those things now. That's it.
Yeah.
So
I think these conversations are so important. I think it's so important for other people to be able to hear them, to know that it's natural for, you know, to be nervous about this, to not know. But what you said there about, like, I'm good, that was a... My two older kids also, especially the oldest one, were and are really into video games, and were, you know, are kind of that classic what we perceive unschooling to be, which is the kid who's in front of a computer all day long playing a computer game, and you're going, oh my God, what am I doing? Is this wrong? As a parent, to let them do this sort of, and I don't want to go too deep into the technology, no technology debate. But for me, it was the same. I just kept checking in with myself and I kept coming back with, well, they're social, they have friends, they look healthy, they are healthy, they, you know, they're they're interested in things. They're interesting people. They're kind. They're empathetic. They talk to their grandparents. Yeah, they have other hobbies and habits that show me that they're healthy human beings. So who the hell am I to interrupt them at all in their process? They're doing fine, and they don't need my suggestions or advice at this point in time. And if they do, I'd have conversations with them. And I think a lot of it's about sincerity, isn't it? Like, yeah. I would go up to them and say, but they knowing that they can push back and I would listen to them, I would go up to them and say, hey, you know, you've been on your computer all day long and I'm concerned. Like, maybe you want to take a walk in the park with me or whatever? And sometimes they'd say, you know what? Yeah, you're right. And sometimes they say, leave me alone. I'm in the middle of something with my friends. Get lost. Yeah. And I think, but they knew that I was being sincere and that I care about them and I love them. And just like a peer or a spouse or whatever, a partner, like I can go up to them and say, I love you and I'm concerned. And then you can turn around and say, well, you know, I hear you and I appreciate you being concerned about me. And I'll take that as input because I care about you too. And your input is important to me. But I'm going to go on and make my own decisions. And I think that's what we need to strive for in all relationships in life, but most especially in relationships with the young people in our lives who so often get that sort of a relationship with older people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still so turbulent as the caregivers of these people.
It sure is.
It's pretty turbulent inside. So I'm going to be processing my I'm good for probably the next week because I know that he means it. I do. I know that he feels confident and good. And there's probably a lot of work. And I think I want to talk about it again now because I think I'm thinking about anybody that could be listening who might be experiencing something similar mm-hmm. with teenagers or young people who are transitioning.
Yeah.
There is... a lot of it is our own stuff to untangle quietly and not with our children, because I think we can overexpress our fears and overexpress our concerns. And that looks like to young people, you know, that we don't trust them, that we don't have confidence. And that comes back to relationship. And if you have a good, strong relationship and it's built on a foundation of trust, then your own fears and worries, you got to be able to untangle those quietly on your own, because when you give that narrative to them and kind of have them hold that with you at the same time, it sends the opposite signal. It says, you do not trust me. You don't trust what we've done. You don't trust that I'm competent and whole, and you've said it all this time, and now it seems like you're not really believing it, you know?
I actually just had a very similar conversation with my therapist, not about young people at all, but about being in a relationship and talking about those moments where you realize the issue isn't the other person or your relationship with the other person. The issue is your problems and your baggage that you brought into that relationship, and that you need to do the work and leave them alone. They have nothing to do with this part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so true so often with young people, is we're taking our own de-schooling, we're taking our own insecurities, our own, you know, how our parents treated or mistreated us in certain regards, and burdening young people who are just fine and don't need that on them. A good example of this, like a practical example of this, is in the methodology of play work. So the people who work on junk playgrounds that are typically accessed only by young people and some adults who are trained to be in those playgrounds that have loose parts materials that they can do with as they please, oftentimes called junk. The play workers, the trained adults who are on those playgrounds, are trained to understand their own anxieties and their own fears. And an example of that I can remember when I was working as a play worker was, I sometimes get nervous when kids climb up trees really high. And I'm aware of the fact that doesn't mean that the young person is not capable of climbing the tree. That means I have some weird fear that I need to work out in my life. And if I put that on to the kid, not only am I possibly oppressing them or imposing my own fear on them, but I might also be putting them in a riskier spot where they have the confidence, but now they don't have the confidence because I'm saying, oh, be careful, be careful. And I might actually be doing worse for them. And so play workers are trained to kind of know your own anxieties with working with young people. And so I was aware of that. And so when kids would climb trees high up, I knew to tag out with another play worker and say, hey, would you mind coming over here to the tree? And I'll go over to some other space. And being aware of that. And I think what you're saying about your own son is, you know, like when we're aware of our own, I was actually surprised when you said you're going to have to work on that for a week. I thought you were going to say you have to work on that for a lifetime, but but knowing that you know, if they're coming to you and you can trust them and you're listening to them and they're saying I'm good, but you're still not sure of it, the problem's in you. The problem's not in them. And taking that quietly and working on it yourself, or working on it with a therapist or your partner or a friend who has kids that you can talk to or something is the way to go about it. Yeah, I love that.
I probably will work on it for a lifetime, accepting that for a lifetime, but like just probably a week came to mind in just accepting, like, he did say that, right? Like he said, I'm good. Like, I'm just going to replay it for a week. But that I recognized that in myself today when he said that, and, you know, I gave him a response and was like, I'm hearing you. This is what I heard you say. I will not bring it up again.
The line that I really like from A.S. Neal, I think it's in Summerhill, and he says, I'd much prefer to have a happy street sweeper than a neurotic prime minister.
Right.
I think that's such an important, like what is a success and what is a failure? And maybe you could be a prime minister and that's great. And maybe you're happy at it. Although my guess is most prime ministers probably aren't very happy people, but that the at the end of it, it's that they're satisfied and they're doing what that they're passionate about and that they are saying I'm good. And that can, and I think that in the teenage years that can get so scary for parents.
Mm-hmm. We got to really practice not clinging to a story that we created of who they might be.
Yeah.
Because I think all parents, no matter what approach you're taking to parenting, you at some point have a story in your mind and you may have to check yourself and be like, whoa, that's my story. I made that up. but you got to constantly check in with yourself about, you know, ideals you have for them. Because I do think that just living a satisfied life, feeling satisfied and fulfilled, can look so different for so many different types of people. And we shouldn't be the ones to place like a moral assignment on what that should look like. Yeah. So that they choose only within like a certain range of things that like would be acceptable to their parents. So, well, to take it back to the article that I had you read for accessibility and also just so that I could hear you read it. you mentioned oppression. You mentioned when you were talking about kids climbing in the tree and you said you could potentially be oppressing them. I know that language matters to you and words are important to you. I knew that even before you made the distinction between traditional and conventional, but what is childhood oppression and what is childhood liberation?
Yeah, that's, the simplest definition of it, the most obvious definition is, you know, letting them make their own choices versus making choices for them, whether they like it or not, right? But that's the easy one. That one I think anybody can figure out. But there's so much more beyond that. Even if you take a kid out of a conventional classroom and you let them go make their own choices, whether you're unschooling them or putting them in a self-directed space of some sort. The rest of it is really, it has so much to do with fear. And I mean the adult's fear, what we've been talking about. There was a book that came out, I want to say, maybe about 15 years ago now by Matt Hearn called Watch Yourself, Why Safer Isn't Always Better. And I I think that that book, when I read it at the time, literally gave me chills. Actually, here, Matt, who's one of my heroes, hearing him speak is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. He's just such a well-spoken person and has such great thoughts on this. But that book in particular gave me a lot of insight into what we're talking about here. And he said, we justify so much in the name of safety. And what safety is, and the book goes on to all these wonderful, wonderful examples. You know, like the first one that comes to mind is, I might have this fact a little bit off, but this is how I remember reading it in the book, which is in the United States, the same number of people die per day from cigarette smoke as died in 9/11. And yet cigarettes are still legal. But we have people with machine guns all over protecting us from terrorists. Or he starts off the book, maybe even a better example is, I think his original inquiry into writing the book, because from what I recall, the first chapter is about how his oldest daughter at the time wanted to walk to school by herself. And he was nervous to let her walk by herself. And he started questioning himself, why is he nervous? And so he sat down and thought, well, I'm scared she's going to be abducted. So he looked up the statistics. And he also noted that he lived basically in the same place and went to a school basically in the same place when he was a kid. And he walked by himself to school and his parents were fine with it. There was no issue. But here he is a generation later feeling like he can't allow, for safety purposes, he can't allow his daughter to walk to school by herself, though she wanted to, right? And I think though she wanted to is an important part of this. Right. The oppression here, right? And so he looked up the statistics and found out that basically in where he lives in Vancouver, that virtually in Vancouver, the abduction rate hasn't changed in 30 years. And that there were like, you know, and as I think a lot of people maybe know, that people are almost always abducted by people who know them. So, you know, from the parent who doesn't have custody or the grandparent or, you know, some sort of a situation like that. It's very rare for a person to actually be abducted otherwise, including children. And so he thought, well, if the rate of abductions hasn't changed, why is he feeling so much more nervous about this than his parents were? And he sort of starts at this inquiry into what is safety and what is our perception of safety. And, you know, your safety is our priority, right? You see that slogan splattered all over the place. My safety is not your priority at all. Your liability insurance is your priority. That's what you're talking about. You could care less about me. Your profit margins are your priority. Yeah. But we justify so much in the names of safety, and we convince ourselves as parents, as care providers, as educators, as people of manipulating and controlling children in the name of what we think is safety.
Yes.
My favorite statistic was I worked at an organization called Studio in a School, New York City, an organization that places professional artists into schools that don't have enough funding for the arts. And they write grants to bring artists in and train the teachers and work with the young people there. And they at the time when I was working at Studio in a School, and this goes back 15 years now, they had been around for something like 30 or 40 years. So they had gathered all these statistics on how children, how they work with different art materials. And the statistic that was most fascinating to me was in 1975, when the organization opened, or right around then, the average 4-year-old capably could use a pair of adult scissors. And it was around 2000, a little after 2000, when it was the average 7-year-old. So here we were talking about a 25-year period, roughly, and it had almost doubled. Now, children hadn't changed. There wasn't anything different about, or for the most part, about children are children, right? And yet the ability to use scissors had almost jumped up 3 years. And it's because we're so scared to give children scissors that they're going to hurt themselves or something. And it's that type of oppression And that's literally a type of oppression. It's one we don't necessarily know we're making, but we're taking away children's control and their ability to do all sorts of things that they're completely capable of doing of. And when they want to do it, like Matt Hearn's daughter who wanted to walk to school, and we justify not letting them do it out of safety, but for no reason whatsoever, that like we haven't actually looked up the statistics or quantified whether or not that's actually safe or not. It just feels unsafe to us because people aren't doing it, because my next door neighbors might look at me and give me dirty looks, or the teacher might say, you know, that's dangerous, or child services might come and say, how dare you let your child walk to school by themselves? And we're nervous about that, that we're justifying it as safety. And that's the type of oppression I'm talking about that's so hard to pinpoint for all adults nowadays.
Right. So it's almost as if, well, first of all, I love that this is a distinction when we're talking about this kind of childhood oppression, because it is so, it's just like a thin layer over child rearing that everybody sort of accepts, like spring pollen just falling on all of us. Like we just accept that it's going to happen and we're going to have allergies because of it.
Yeah.
Childhood oppression doesn't have to look like, you know, keeping a child hostage in their home or, you know, beating them. Those are all obviously oppressive and abusive things. These are things that we've all accepted as just normal, like a normal way to interact and engage with young people in society. And it's almost as if we've done it for the sake of standardization, because
It's
just easier to manage. One child cuts their finger on scissors, and either it's a big deal because they're really, really harmed, or their parents are really upset about it. And so in come safety scissors, and we start using the blunt-ended safety scissors, which, by the way, most kids hate. They don't fit your hands that well, and they don't cut that well.
it actually turns you away from being creative because you don't have the right tools for the right job. I love painting. That's sort of my passion behind all of this. And if you hand me a paintbrush that's, you know, where the bristles are all sticking out, it frustrates the hell out of me. And I don't want to paint because I can't get a straight line. And you do that over and over again with children's tools, they're going to feel the same way about it, and they're going to be turned off from it. I was going to give one. A lot of people will say, "Oh, well, it's fine, Alex. You know, you've somehow figured out the resources or have the environment to have a bunch of free kids in a free space, and so you can let them do all that stuff." But how do I do that in a public school setting, or how do I do that at home, or, you know, with my parents frowning on me and I'm nervous about them, having a co-parent who doesn't believe in this type of stuff? I want to give one quick example, because I think that concrete examples are the most helpful for people. It's my one classroom management approach or methodology when I walk into a public school. So I have in the last few years, it's been a couple of years, but since the pandemic, I haven't been doing it. But about 4 years ago or so, I was still working in public schools doing like junk play types of projects. So I bring in junk and let kids play with it or come up with different things. And so I was going into conventional schools with conventionally schooled kids who, if you haven't worked with conventionally schooled kids and then tried to give them freedom, I have, and it can look very bad very quickly, which is, you know, hey, you're free. If you tell somebody who hasn't been allowed to watch television their whole lives, all of a sudden you can watch television, what are they going to do? They're going to binge watch television, mm-hmm. Right? It's very hard to go into a public school and do that. So I was running these really fun after-school junk play programs. And the kids could choose from, you know, a dozen different after, you know, there was the chess club, there were reading groups, there were acting and music groups, and I was doing the junk play one. And in this one particular school, I remember it spread pretty quickly. Hey, take this guy's after school class because he's crazy and he's, you know, he's fun and he'll let us do whatever sort of a thing. And my one bit, this goes back to the sincerity and how to work with young people. So when I'd get kids who would start getting out of control, where they were damaging property, damaging another kid, doing something that was risky to the point where, you know, the school, like, they're going to be in trouble, I'm going to be in trouble, whatever. I would go up to the kid and I would say to them, and I've done this many times, and say to them, look, you like being in my program, right? I'm like, and you want me to be here so that you can, even if it's just do nothing, you know, just not even, because I'll respect your right to not even participate if you don't. But kids usually loved the stuff that I was doing with them. And I'm like, so you need me, you want me to be here. And if I'm not here, then this isn't going to be available to you. But if you start smashing the window or shaking that other kid or cursing at the top of your lungs, sooner or later, the principal's going to come walking into this classroom and you're going to be in trouble. But even more importantly, I'm going to end up in trouble, and I might even lose my job. And if I lose my job, then I'm not going to be here anymore, and you're not going to be able to do this anymore. So I'm fine with you doing anything. We can figure out the rest together, as long as you're respecting the other people that are here and you're not doing anything that's pulling the principal in, that, you know, damaging the school or something like that. And when you break it down for them that way, and you're like, look, I remember one of the kids in that same exact class really didn't want to be in my class for some reason. And because I wasn't an actual teacher in the school, they had to have even though I'm a certified teacher, they had to have a teacher from the school in my class who would be, and their job was to sit in the corner and scroll through Instagram. And the teacher was like, sit down and shut up. You're in this class. And the kid, and this was a middle schooler, started crying. And I remember being like, man, you know, like, for a middle schooler to be openly crying in front of their peers is like, they're really upset and really unhappy. So I sat down next to the kid. When the teacher started scrolling through their Instagram or whatever over in the corner and wasn't paying attention, I sat down next to the kid and I whispered in their ear, I'm like, leave. And they're like, what? And I was like, get out of here. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, you don't want to be here. And they're like, yeah, but I'm going to get in trouble. And I was like, don't worry, I'll cover for you. I'll say you're in the bathroom. And the kid's looking at me, the teacher, telling them to go play hooky and get out of the class. They're looking at me like, are you crazy? I remember the kid, he goes, but my backpack is over there. And I went, go into the hallway. I'll get your backpack. I'll meet you in 1 minute. And I, sure enough, I did. And the look on that kid's face, I'll never forget, was priceless. Was looking at me like, I can't believe an adult is breaking me out of school. But the point of the story is that, you know, to not be oppressive to kids doesn't necessarily mean that you need to have the ideal environment. Right? It can be any type of an environment. And maybe I couldn't even break the kid out of the class. Maybe it's just going, or the other kid who was misbehaving in a way that was going to get the principal in. But if I can speak to them as human beings and say, look, what you're doing isn't cool, or I know you don't want to be in this class, and I'm so sorry that you have to be here. I wish you could get out. All of a sudden, I'm treating them like a human. And that's really all we're talking about. And that's getting rid of the oppression. Yeah.
And, you know, it's wild. They, these young people, they understand reason and logic pretty well.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah. You just explain it to them. It makes sense. They're not incapable of like computing adult language the way that adults kind of make it seem that they are. And I get why there's standardization and why we systemize things. I get why that all exists in school systems and other systems like prison systems, but it doesn't mean that like we can't find pockets, like you're saying, to advocate for youth, to give them a voice, to give them opportunities. I'm guessing there probably wasn't more than 15 minutes of class left, and that's probably why you let them go to the bathroom at the end. Like, just take off, just leave. Say you're in the bathroom. I don't know. But actually, this kind of reminds me, taking it back to the article again, of how it's really so nuanced around oppression and liberation, and kind of why I wanted to talk to you about, well, initially it was the diagram before it was the article, because the diagram was the first thing I had an introduction to, which on its own was like, whoa, like so much that I was processing just looking at it. So That'll be linked for everyone to read and look at. But that was really what drew me in first and has, for the last couple of years, just compelled me to think so, so much. Not because it's like you wrote down, you know, some doctrine or truth that's like, you know, some tablet that's going to be etched in history forever and like this is the one truth, but because it's so interesting, especially if you have like worked within some of these centers or you are unschooling and have encountered the variety of different unschooling models that there are. And I wanted to talk to you more about whether or not fear-based models equal childhood oppression, like full stop, and trust-based models equal childhood liberation, full stop. I have an inkling that you're going to say that things are more nuanced than that, but I wanted to talk about that and how I really think that some people have looked at this diagram and went, whoa, 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 this is just kind of calling what I do, you know, insert political ideology they don't want to be associated with, which I know you weren't trying to do.
I do want to just preface by saying that diagram was something I had created for a conference just for people who weren't familiar with self-directed education and just to introduce them to it, but also to kind of give them the understanding that just like with the conventional methodologies and the conventional models that they were familiar with, there's a flavor of self-directed ones and there's a broad spectrum of them and that you can't really pigeonhole it into this one or the other. So that was why I had originally created it. And then I had put it into an article on Tipping Points and for the magazine for the Alliance for Self-Directed Education, of which I'm the co-editor. I had just put it in as like an afterthought for an illustration for something. And so many people got up in arms about that diagram that this article I just read to you was requested to write an article that explained the diagram. And I do want to say one of my claims to fame is that because of this article, Education is a Political Act, my resignation was asked for by a group of people that I won't mention their names because they were so up in arms about me calling them a particular political ideology that they were angry and they thought, you know, I shouldn't be an editor who can represent all of self-directed education if I think this way, which I'm quite proud that I wrote something that elicited such emotions from people that they asked for that. But by no means was this diagram ever meant to be like what you said. It's not meant to be a truth whatsoever. In fact, it's kind of a clunky diagram in many ways. Like somebody was like, oh, because on the, you know, like the schools or the method, the different types of methodologies listed underneath the circles at the top go from a top to bottom. They were like, is there a hierarchy of this? And I was like, oh no, I just couldn't fit the words in to put them next to each other. And then when I realized that it looks like there's a hierarchy, I was like, oh, this is bad. So by no means am I saying that the diagram is great by any means. It was just meant to do what it sounds like it did for you, which makes me really happy, which is just to get people to think about this. And I think wherever you are on that spectrum, and even if you don't believe in my diagram, to be thinking about the fact that the framework in which we put young people for years and years and years, that framework of a methodology, of an ideology behind that methodology, is going to set up a framework in their mind for the way that they think, even in a self-directed environment, right? If I put a kid in a school that focuses more on individual autonomy than in communal freedom, they're going to think in a more individualistic way. And actually, you and I'd like to assume that you and I can agree on this one, which is not being in the United States as much at the moment. I've seen so much the difference between definitions of what freedom means and the United States general definition of freedom so often means individual freedom. I am free. I can make my own choices, therefore I'm free. And in a lot of other parts of the world, freedom is seen much more as a communal thing. I have to be free with a group of other people or in a society or my whole corporation or whatever it is that you're, you know, my whole village or community. And that's what freedom is seen as. And that creates a structural difference in the way you act on a daily basis. And what you choose to do as a job or the way you choose to communicate with people or the way you go to the supermarket, it all changes based on that. And if you raise somebody in one system versus another, that doesn't mean that they're always going to look at things that way, but they're going to have to de-school themselves out of that framework that you've put them in. And so even in a self-directed education environment, think very carefully about how you're setting up freedom for those kids. As far as what you were saying, yeah, it is more nuanced, but there are fear-based and trust-based models. And, you know, in my diagram, again, one of the faults is that I made it a dichotomy, right? You're either fear-based or you're a trust-based model. And we know that's not true. Not all teachers in all public schools are necessarily imposing fear upon their students, or not all the time, at least, right?
Right.
And not necessarily the reverse is I've worked in many, many self-directed environments, and I have seen plenty of self-directed facilitators who thought that they were giving kids autonomy, imposing fearful structures upon them without realizing that they were doing it. And so I think, you know, again, I simplified it too much, but I simplified it to give a quick narrative to help people start thinking about it.
I like the simplicity of it for that reason. I like that it forces me to have to really stare at it, and I'm staring at it currently, and like really try to see what you were getting across. Because when I got it, it was away from the article. It was passed to me through someone on Instagram at some point a couple years back, and I was working in Sudbury at the time, so I was very much in community that wasn't one that I like specifically, you know, built on my own and like wasn't outside of a system. It was within a framework that I just kind of came into and was told to follow. So it came across to me at a time where I was really thinking a lot more about self-directed education in centers, and what that looked like and what equity looked like and what community care looked like. Because I found it, quite honestly, challenging to commit to community care within the Sudbury model, because the nature of the model doesn't really have time where everyone is together to even share what needs might be in the community. You know, there's no time to bring awarenesses. And so I just was noticing things like that about the place and space that I was in, and it got me thinking about all of the other models that are out there and ways that they are getting to what I feel like are the most important things when you're in community is the care of everyone and making sure that the community is built and set in a way that is supportive to all of the people that are involved in it, which is hard to do. It's a lot of work to do. I think it's really hard for a model to have across the board like that work the same everywhere, because all Sudburys are not created equal, just like all, you know, Waldorf schools, et cetera, are not created equal.
The one example that I give, which is, I guess, tooting my own horn a little bit, since I'm the one who came up with the methodology of flying squads, but I'm just speaking from my own experience. There's plenty of other environments that can create, that have and do work in such ways. But the one that by mistake, so the idea of flying squads for me came about from I was running a free school, and then I was running a sort of like a free school-y camp, summer camp. It was in a free school in Brooklyn. I was running the summer camp. And all these conventionally schooled parents who literally during the school year were like pulling their kids away from me, like, oh, he's the crazy guy who sends his kids to the school where kids can do whatever they want, and thought that I was nuts and would never send their kids to school, were signing their kids up for my summer camp. And I thought, this is weird. Why are they, you know, I'm like trying to, as the parents are coming to pick up their kids from the summer camp, I'm trying to like hide the fact that we poured out paint. And their, you know, the kids had dipped their arms in it up to their elbows, and the couches were all tipped over, and we'd make forts out of them and stuff. And you know, I was sort of like nervous, and the parents were praising me, and I kept selling out the summer camp. And in fact, somebody else runs that summer camp now, and it does really, really well. And I was really confused. Why were these conventionally schooled parents all of a sudden like excited, not only just like paying me good money to have their kids have this experience in the summer? And then it hit me, oh, this wasn't education. This is the playtime. It's the summertime. And if I don't call it education, all of a sudden some parents are okay with that, right? Or let's say this, a lot more parents are okay with that than just the small amount of parents who are okay with that during the school year, which ultimately led me to opening up a junk playground. Because I realized, oh, if I start a playground like this, I can create a lot more experiences for young people to come in and have these types of experiences whose parents aren't going to send them to that type of a school. Sure, on Saturday, I'll bring you there for 4 hours, but you know, I'm not going to send you there for 30 hours each week for school. And while, you know, ultimately my goal was have schools like this, I thought if you can give kids that opportunity, it's great for the kids. Parents can then see their kids doing that, maybe trust the kids a bit more, and so on and so forth. But what I didn't like about the junk playgrounds was, and this gets back to what we were just talking about, I promise. What I didn't like about the junk playgrounds is that they were fenced in. So, hey, kids, you're free in here. Once you walk outside the fence, tough luck. And I thought, how can I do this in an area that has no fence? How can I let kids have the decisions over what materials they use and what they do and where they want to go and all that type of stuff, not within a junk playground, but just anywhere? And I tried the first thing I tried was a program where I got kids lost in New York City, and it was remarkable how many rich people in New York want their kids to get lost. I kept selling out these programs where I'd be like, all right, give me your kids, and we're going to go into some random neighborhood in New York, and it's like, good luck, kids, get home. There was more to it than that. Like, I wasn't abandoning them; I was going with them. But but I didn't like the fact that it was still a top-down structure, and I was like, oh, I'm the one bringing them to a neighborhood. And I was like, how do I get it where really it has nothing to do with me whatsoever? And I realized, and that's what flying squads are. And flying squads are this: go to a public space, get a bunch of parents to agree to let their kids go to that public space with you. Say to their kids, "What do you want to do?" And go do it. That's it, right? So I was like, oh, this is great. And it is, flying squads are more fun than anything I've ever done with anyone ever. And I highly recommend just do it with your kids on the weekend, whatever. So that was my whole thought process into it, was just that. But then after doing it for like a year, I realized something that I had. So I was also working, I was doing flying squads in the beginning, only 1 or 2 days a week. And on the other days, I was working in a self-directed unschooling center, right? Mm-hmm. And I noticed a huge difference, which was because some of the kids were the same kids. Some of the kids were on flying squad were with me at the unschooling center. And I noticed that when, let's say for an example, because it's easiest with a conflict, when a conflict arises in the self-directed center, right, one kid is making a loud noise and they won't stop and they're saying they're allowed to do that and blah, 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 and another kid's annoyed by it. The other kid goes into another room and does something else, right? Mm-hmm. You have the same scenario play out in a flying squad where you're all in a public space together in your group of people and somebody starts doing something annoying, or somebody wants to go to a place that nobody else wants to go to and is insisting on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, there's no other room to go to. You're all there together. And I think that was, and all of a sudden it was painful. It's extremely painful because you're stuck together and you have to figure it out together. You can't just leave that person and go to another place. You have to, unless you're going to drop out. You have to work it out together. And all of a sudden I noticed that in flying squads, we were caring about each other so much more than we were in the self-directed
center in a different way. And I don't necessarily mean to say that flying squads are better than a center. It just gives a different emphasis. And I think also like if you're in a flying squad 5 days a week, it's probably too exhausting and you are going to drop out. So like having some space and time where I can go into another room and ignore you is a healthy thing. I should be able to walk away from you, but having to confront you sometimes and have to deal with you, man, if you can figure that out at 8 years old or 10 years old or 14 years old, you're doing so much better than most 48-year-olds that I know, because there's difficult people and there's people who we don't agree with in the world, and knowing how to get along with them or even just like bide your time until you can go find another space is huge. Like if you can figure that one out, like, whoa, you've just figured out most of life. My point in this is the type of space and then type of environment you set up helps like whether I have to work with you or whether I can go be autonomous. And that really gets to what I'm talking about in this article of like, is there mutual aid? Am I caring about you or am I just free in the space doing my own thing? Right. And both can be good, and different amounts of different and different ages or different activities or whether it's raining outside or not can completely change which one is the better one to have at the moment. But understanding that you have an array of those types of experiences accessible to you if you want, I think is hugely important for people in self-directed education.
Yeah. You like went directly to the direction I was going around the types of freedom that you listed in the article, freedom with a focus on autonomy, with a focus on community, or through mutual aid. Those three really stood out to me in the article. That and the big takeaway at the end were the things that stood out to me the most after getting past the diagram. And my question that I was thinking about around those three different approaches of freedom is, are those views or approaches fixed? And I think you've just answered that they're not fixed, that, you know, you can have times in your day or your week or your life where you do have freedom with a focus on your own autonomy. And it is about you and going into like your creative space or whatever it is that you're doing. And there are times where you can do it with a focus on community, even if it's a community that you like don't necessarily even like everyone there. And then through mutual aid, like I just think that we can, be fluid between those ways of being, and that no one has to be, which I think the internet can sometimes make us feel like it is all or nothing, but no one has to be like 100% focused on everybody in the community all the time with everything. Right. Like we would be so burnt out. In fact, I would venture to say it's why many of us are very burnt out, because we are going to do that, and it's not possible all the time.
I'm definitely feeling that burnout in my own life.
You can't do it all, you know? I've recently, on our Discord server, I've had to recently say, and it was hard at first for me to let go, but I had to say, like, I cannot be present for this chat. I will not be present for this support circle. Like, I was quite literally in the air traveling. I felt deeply apologetic that I couldn't be there, that it's a thing that I'm supposed to host. But, like, the community can and does function without me.
Yeah.
Hey, we all have things that we have to do sometimes that are not 100% community focused or, you know, through a channel of mutual aid happening. Sometimes we're different.
I do want to just say one other, because the reason why people were asking for my resignation over this article, and just to make it really clear, is I am not at all professing that to be a proponent of self-directed education, you need to be a libertarian, an anarchist, or a socialist. That's not what this article is saying at all. The article, in fact, very explicitly states that.
Yes.
But some people get so emotional over that. Oh my God, you just labeled me an anarchist. Oh my God, well, actually, none of the anarchists were upset. but some of the other ones I won't mention the names of were upset about that. And that's not the point of it. It's the ideology behind it, that there's a structure behind it. There's a framework. I really like the word framework behind it. Actually, one other thing I will say, that one of my biggest pet peeves in self-directed education is when people talk about structure. And people say, oh, well, my child needs structure, so they need to go to a public school. Your school doesn't have any structure. And I always point out then that, you know, the example I always give is the trying to decide, having a group of people trying to decide what movie to go to. If I, as an authoritarian figure, say to you, we're going to go see Batman at the Lowe's Cinema at 8 o'clock on Friday night, be there. There was very little structure to that. It was, I told you something, you listened to it. Right. Whereas for me to create a consensus based where each of us can talk about whether we like Batman and if Lowe's Cinema is too capitalistic for us or, you know, too far from home and, or, you know, and 8 p.m. is too late for me or whatever. Like all of a sudden, if I want to actually have equal voices for each person in that group, I have to create a whole lot of structure to be able to do that. So with that in mind, a self-directed space actually has significantly more structure than a conventional space does, because you need to set it up that if it's going to work well, it needs to have more structure. And so, as I always point out to people, so when you say your child needs more structure, what you mean is they need to be told what to do.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, in any case, I don't know how I got off of that, but the whole point of this isn't, I was just talking about frameworks. The whole point of that isn't about who you vote for, whether you like Donald Trump or Joe Biden or neither of them, right? It has nothing to do with that. I'm just talking about what framework you put into a space or just for your kids at home or wherever they are is going to impact the way they look at the world.
Right.
To some extent. And it's really important to think about that while you're doing it or before you do it, and make sure that you're feeling good about that. And yes, that can alternate, that can change on a daily basis. In fact, one of the reasons why I love unschooling so much is my kids have got to see, like, they're in different types of, they're tutoring one-on-one with someone, they're in small groups. They're in big groups. They meet different people. You know, like some of their tutors come from a very conventional background. Some people are complete unschoolers. They've met all different people from all walks of life. And so they've gotten to dabble in different frameworks throughout their whole life experience because they're running into all different people rather than just being in one particular center with the same group of people over and over again. But I think it's important, just as it's important to introduce your kids to a diversity of different types of human beings and for them to understand that, I think a diversity of frameworks and realizing that not all of them are necessarily, the other example I always give is traffic lights. I tried to come up with a democratic traffic light. And it's like, it might not always be a good idea for us to get to an intersection and vote who gets to go through the intersection first. There might be a more efficient way of doing it. And while it might be authoritarian to get through that traffic light, we might all just listen to the red light because it might just help us. And that other times we might want to sit and debate who the equity of who gets through the traffic light first. And so different frameworks can be useful for different reasons at different times.
It's so true. Like in a lot of Europe, there are a lack of traffic lights and a lot of traffic circles.
Yeah.
There is that sort of like game of like who was in there first? Am I going to be able to like swoop in or not? In other places, like in the USA, there are lights everywhere and a lack of traffic circles. And the lights are just needed to keep all of those intersection collisions at a low or a somewhat low.
Because we're used to the traffic light. We're used to there's a red, there's a green, somebody's telling me when to go and when not to go. I wrote another article in Tipping Points about intersections that's one that I love. And at the end of the article, I talk about in parts of Vietnam where literally it's like throw your neck into the intersection and people will stop and let you go through. And so it becomes this, but how, because they're all on motorcycles or mopeds, they see each other's faces and the body language and the gestures, and they're able to get through it. Whereas where we're in these big car containers, we can't negotiate as well. And how, you know, the different types of intersections and the different types of decisions we make and how culturally that changes things.
It does.
Yeah.
It really does. I love the way you described unschooling specifically for your young people. unschooling to me is a dynamic way of living. It is being in the world, not hidden away from it.
Yeah.
It is very much interacting with people of all types, not just, you know, the home learning types. And I think people get really wrapped around the axle when home learning or alternative solutions to school, conventional schooling, indicate any like alignment with any sort of political ideology. Yeah. It doesn't matter, left, right, center, up, down, it does not matter. It always ruffles feathers. And I think it's because politics, like just literally the word politics, makes people cringe. It makes like, it's like a really gross word that we shouldn't say. And like, when you say it, you almost see people kind of like, they tuck their shoulders in and look around like, did someone hear me say that? And people don't want to associate anything with politics. And I think the reason why people don't want to think about it as it relates to politics is because that gets you too close to too much information that just feels pressing, because once you like know certain things, you kind of can't unknow them. And I think maybe that little bit of fear leads a lot of adults to not want to lean into anything that signifies political alignment to something. But I love that this article like brings it back to the idea that whether or not you align with anything directly or indirectly, these worldviews exist. We exist in a geopolitical environment. Yes. That you cannot take away. Like that's not going, you can't keep that from your child's life. They will eventually be a part of a geopolitical system that is all tied together, and those worldviews exist, and they all have, you know, things that they may cause, whether they be problematic or not, in how your child moves throughout the world when they're an adult. So if we're responsible for guiding them and leading them, I do feel like the responsible thing to do is to look a little deeper into some of those things and make some adjustments, you know?
I think it's really interesting. Part of what plays into this, like I've had kids come up to me and say, oh, you're vegan? Well, how do you get any protein? Right. And then having to have that conversation with them and choosing whether or not I talk to them about veganism or not. Right. Is a thing. But now let's take out veganism and let's put in God. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're an atheist. You know, how do you, you know, get through without living an existentially angst life, you know? or whatever. Right. You know, like, and the vegan one, maybe a teacher would talk about. The God one, no way, right? Like, oh, that's not my place. But it's so interesting what we choose, like, or, you know, like, do you talk to kids about abortion? Do you talk about gun control? Whatever, like, you take any hot topic. Are we allowed to talk to kids about this or not? Like, and I don't mean necessarily, well, even as a parent, sometimes we wonder. But certainly as a, you know, you're my kid's teacher. Do you talk about this? Most people say no. Like, that's dangerous. You don't do that. That's a parent's role and that sort of a thing. And I sort of say, like, well, I need to make sure that I tell them that this is my opinion, and I need to make sure that they're aware of other ones. But like, I guess I'm almost even arguing that there should be religion in school, in a sense, in that, like, we should be talking about all this stuff. Like, there shouldn't be anything that's sacred and forbidden. We should feel the ability to feel comfortable and be in relationship with other human beings and be able to talk about anything. And I think the most important part about this is, if I choose not to talk about those things, if I choose, an obvious one is, if I choose not to talk about abortion with children, because that's for you to talk about with your parents, not in a school setting with me, right? I have made a political ideological decision. Mm-hmm. Whether just by saying no to this, I have made a decision, and that's fine. Maybe that is your decision, but knowing that you did make a decision on that is really important. And to know that that's going to impact the way those kids grow up and the way they perceive things. And that's all I mean by this whole article. Is it can be anything. You can choose anything, and you can, whatever your answer is, fine. But your answer is giving a framework.
It is, yes. And I think it ties back into what you said at the top around control under the guise of safety. So in this case, maybe it's the safety of you knowing too much too soon, preserving your childhood and innocence. Like, I've heard a lot of different reasons that people give for why some of those topics wouldn't be discussed with a child if they ask. And it's always, almost always, the adult just being fearful of tackling that conversation, whether it's because they never really had it talked about with them, or they're just, they weren't mentally prepared yet, or they have a religious opposition to that idea, or whatever the case may be. Everything we do and say to these young people informs how they view the world.
Even if we don't say anything.
Even if you don't say anything. And the interesting thing about that, and we bump up against this a lot in our family with the variety of people we have been in relationship with over the years, is my kids can notice when other kids, like specifically under the religious kind of bubble, are being, like, information's being withheld. And we have this really interesting dance as a family of protecting other people's right to their worldview and the way that they raise their families, but also not, we're not going to lie to ourselves or participate in anything that doesn't feel right for us. But they have been able to identify, like, oh my gosh, those young people don't, they don't know everything. They don't have all the information. I don't like that they don't have all the information. And it brings up a lot of conversations in our family just about the variety of ways that people raise children, and the different approaches and religions, and how, you know, different intersections, your race, your ethnicity, your class, all of those things, how they all intersect to form an experience for different people. And that is just, that's our dynamic way of unschooling. A lot of it is through conversation. So I hope that the way that you have shared how you have unschooled your children, and the bits that I've shared, and the questions and answers around the article, hopefully those help people in some way. And I really appreciate you reading the article and making it more accessible to people and give people a place to go and click and listen to it. I know you're a very busy person and you have so much going on, and it's, you still have a day ahead of you. So before I let you go, is there anything that you want to share, or a place that you want people to be able to find you or not find you?
Oh gosh, I don't know. Self-directed.org, the Alliance for Self-Directed Education is a wonderful, a wonderful resource, although I'm guessing probably a lot of the people listening to this are aware of that one already. For me, I don't really have it's funny, I build websites for a living, but I don't really have much of an online presence. you're welcome to share my contact information with people or whatever. I'm always happy to. I'm a real believer that it's our responsibility to help support each other through this with our questions and try and explain things. And, you know, and when I have my own doubts, to have people to call up and, or share things with and get feedback, which is one of the reasons why I love the work that you do. And you know how I'm such a huge fan of the zine.
Hate that.
feel free to pass on that, but otherwise, just
I'll drop your email in there. I'll put your email so people can email you if they have questions or what. And all of your writing is on ASDE. You don't have it anywhere else, do you? Or on Tipping Points?
Yeah, on Tipping Points is really the one place. That's really if for most of this stuff. Otherwise, if people have specific questions, I'm happy to correspond with people. But other than that, just enjoy life and do the best you can to be a sincere, trusting parent, guardian, care provider, peer to young people. I love, you know, in Romanian, they use the word colleague. Literally, the word is colleague. But they use it for so much more than what we use it for in English, that it can mean like other students in your class or just like other people in a group or whatever. And I think that's a word that I want to use more often. Like I very often am a colleague to young people, where I'm not above them, not below them, not facilitating anything. I'm just with them. They're my colleague.
I love that so much, Alex.
Yeah, maybe I'll leave on that. Let's all try and be colleagues. Not even just a young man. Let's just try and be colleagues to the rest of us in the world.
That's fantastic. I love that so much. I'm thinking about young people who email me for the zine. And they email me so confidently all on their own, like, hey, Megan, here's my submission for the zine. And I'm like, hey, colleague, that's literally what I'm thinking about now. So those are my colleagues. I love that you are introducing this new linguistic beauty to me. Words are just so cool. Words are the coolest thing ever. They're always evolving. They're fluid. They're culturally different around the world. I love that you also have that appreciation.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. For talking with me.
This is my pleasure and truly an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Alex, for spending all of this time with me and really getting in the weeds. I appreciate you so much. We have some really great episodes coming up. Next time, you will hear from Cassidy Younghands, an educator and facilitator who has had the experience of interning at various self-directed education centers and shares her experiences in it all. Before you go, I want to invite you to join me in community over on Discord. There you will find opportunities to connect with other unschooling families, facilitators, and caregivers. We have virtual events like casual coffee chats and support circles and book and film club and lots of discussion channels to reach out with questions or to find unschoolers in your area. Head to theunschoolbells.com and you can get connected there, and you can also partner with me on Patreon from there. I'd love to keep my work sustainable, and my patrons really help me do that, and I am so grateful for you all. Until next time, stay kind to each other.